sort of thing. And I came across the non-employer statistics put out by the U.S. Census Bureau. You cannot come up with a more boring name than the non-employer statistics, right? But I noticed that they had to do with one-person businesses, which was what I wrote about. And what struck me was that there was growth in the number of solo entrepreneurs and partnerships that were getting to $1 million in revenue with no payroll.
This is another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. My guest today is Elaine Pofeld, the author of Million Dollar One-Person Business. She's a past Forbes editor and a current Forbes writer. Is that correct?
I was a senior editor at Fortune Small Business Magazine, and I'm a contributor to Forbes, CNBC, and a number of other business publications about entrepreneurship.
Awesome. Thank you for joining me, first of all.
Oh, my pleasure, Michael.
So what inspired you to write this book is the burning question on my mind.
Well, it came about by accident. I write 5 blogs a month for Forbes, and I was getting towards the end of the month, and I was running out of ideas. So I was kind of Googling around to see what studies had come out and that sort of thing. And I came across the non-employer statistics put out by the U.S. Census Bureau. You cannot come up with a more boring name than the non-employer statistics, right? But I noticed that they had to do with one-person businesses, which was what I wrote about. And what struck me was that there was growth in the number of solo entrepreneurs and partnerships that were getting to $1 million in revenue with no payroll. So I wrote a post about the data. What was very interesting was that they were across many different industries, professional services, personal services, like being a nutritionist or fitness trainer, manufacturing, which you wouldn't think a one-person business could even do, real estate, rental and leasing, informational marketing. There were some categories that seemed to have nothing to do with each other, but they were all getting into the zone of 1 to 2.49 million in revenue to be a real data wonk. So I was really curious about what were they doing. I wrote this post and readers started writing to me. That post went pretty viral. It was over 200,000 page views. And they said, Elaine, that was kind of a cliffhanger. You didn't tell us who the entrepreneurs were. But I couldn't find out from the Census Bureau, because when you fill out those forms, it truly is confidential.
Anonymous. Yeah, totally.
But I was able to write to the readers of Forbes. And I said, if you're one of these people, please write to me and I'd love to cover you. So over about a year, I actually looked back through these and it took me a while. I found 5 of them and I wrote a post. One of them was Alan Walton, the founder of Spy Guy, who is in business now. And he sold cameras, like nanny cameras, that type of thing. And he got to $1 million in revenue on his own. Another one was Dan Mezuritsky, who is a fitness trainer from Canada. He was licensing other fitness trainers as contractors in his methodology. And he created this giant kind of souped up CRM system to manage the whole business. And he got to $1 million. There was Rachel Charlupsky. She founded the babysitting company. She's got 2,500 babysitters that she, until like a month ago, managed by BlackBerry. she started it in college at it was University of Arizona, I believe, or Arizona State. But she's still going strong. She created this high-end service so that if people go on vacation in a hotel, they can feel comfortable that they have a very well-vetted, drug-tested babysitter watching their kids while they go out and explore. There were 5, and that post went crazy viral. And so then I realized I've been writing about entrepreneurship for years and years. I've never had anything that generated as much interest as these posts. So I started, every time I heard from somebody in this category, I would write about them. And then over time, over several years, Lila Campoli, my literary agent, noticed them and she contacted me and said, you know, this would make a great book. And it was kind of in the back of my mind, but I really didn't know my way around the book industry. So we started talking and then that was what led to the book, The $1 Million One-Person Business.
Oh, we got props. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that's all the grandstanding I'm going to do. But it was really fun.
We should probably put it up a little longer so people can
see. Oh, okay. All right. Here it is. So since then I've continued covering these folks for Forbes and I've interviewed well over 70 now. solo entrepreneurs. And it's been really interesting to see what they have in common. I know automation is a big factor for your audience, and automation is a common thread. I've noticed that these folks are optimizers. The reason they get more done and achieve more than the average one-person business is they're very, very efficient in using their time, and they don't spend a lot of time on tasks that would waste their time. They use contractors. They're always learning from other people. They network. They might be introverts, so they network online, perhaps. Some of them are not introverts. They go to in-person events, but they're always learning to be more efficient so that they can enjoy their life outside of work.
So the automation parts, are they focused on one particular skill set area and then they're trying to automate everything else? Or is there a common approach that you're finding to determine what they automate?
Well, like owners of successful employer businesses, they try to focus on the areas of the business that only they can do in general. But what I think is different is that instead of immediately hiring employees, they start thinking about what tasks could I automate, you know, and do more efficiently. For instance, something that we start to take for granted now is scheduling apps, right? Someone like me, I could spend 6 hours a week emailing back and forth, setting up appointments because I'm a journalist. I use Schedule Once. People use Calendly. There's a whole bunch of these different apps. But if you think about it, almost anybody could save one whole day a week by using apps. You know, if you really think about all the mundane tasks you do in your business. So guess what? If you spend that day making money, then you're going to be ahead of where you would be normally with revenue. Or if you spend it on business development, a lot of these folks create space in their life to think more entrepreneurially and think about growing the business and think about their vision instead of just chasing projects and, you know, what are my bills for the business this month or what is my rent this month? They think beyond that. And I think that's why they're achieving so much.
So it sounds like these people that you've been interviewing are less focused on doing the work themselves as opposed to making sure the work gets done. And then what parts of this don't really require humans?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because they're all different in how they do this because each industry is different. One example is Harry Ein, who has a business called Perfection Promo. And what he does is sell swag, basically, like t-shirts with the company's name on it. And I just, I've been recently re-interviewing the people in the book because it's going into paperback to see what happened with everybody in the 2 years since I last spoke with some of them. And what he does is he outsources some of the work to an agency that supports these type of swag businesses, like the invoicing and that sort of thing. But his highest level purpose in the business is going out and meeting with the enterprise customers. So that's a very hands-on kind of thing.
Yeah, very.
But only he is going to bring that passion for selling what he sells. He's very connected to his customers. He has very strong personal relationships. That would be different in a different type of business. So Alan Walton, whom I mentioned, that spy guy, he was originally packing up his cameras himself. He had them in his apartment. And then he realized, this is insane. I've got 100 different types of cameras. So he uses something called Shipping Easy, an automated system to help him with the shipping now. And some people have Amazon stores. They would use Fulfilled by Amazon. And there's a cost to all these things, but they realize there's also a cost to spending their time sticking labels on a box.
Right.
And they could be thinking of bigger things, like how do I break into a whole new country's market? Or how do I introduce a new product? He's gotten into manufacturing because they really are entrepreneurs. They're not just, I don't want to say just, because being a freelancer is hard, but they think of themselves beyond being a solopreneur or freelancer.
So they're trying to create an asset as opposed to a job.
Absolutely. And that was one thing that was really interesting. They're very passionate about their businesses. One thing I noticed, I've done a lot of book events where I'll do a panel of entrepreneurs from the book. How many times the word love comes up on the panels? I noticed this last time and I'm like, I've spent my whole life going to business events, middle market things. You know, you never hear the word love at those events. Right. You know, you just don't hear it. They love what they do. And sometimes the things that they love aren't the things that everyone else loves.
They're really creating a custom lifestyle, it sounds like, around their business, right? It's like focused
absolutely. On absolutely. They find something that they can just become so intense about, but maybe no one else is interested in. So there's a very high bar to entry. One example is ocean audits. Steve Ferreira, who's in the new edition of the book, he's in his late 50s. He's a corporate guy, and he spent his whole career in the shipping industry. The ocean shipping industry specifically, he's an auditor who catches big mistakes on the bill. If, say, JCPenney ordered like 20,000 shirts from China, the shipping company makes a $250,000 mistake. He's like a forensic accountant type. He finds the mistake, and then he goes to Penny's and he says, I found this $250,000 mistake, which I will show to you and collect for you for a 50% commission. Right? Brilliant.
That's huge. So the revenue is not based on his time even. It's like...
And now he's automated it a little bit, but no one could have really done that other than someone who has spent their whole career in this and knows all the ins and outs of finding the mistakes. And not many people, if you really haven't spent your career in it, it's not something that would be that easy to learn. So he's created this beautiful niche for himself. He's got a family. He loves to travel. And so he's able to enjoy his life. And he really loves figuring out... He said he loves the thrill of the hunt, you know? And so not everyone would be as passionate about that business, but each person is passionate about their thing that they do. I mean, Laszlo Nadler in the opening chapter sells planners, like day books on Amazon. He was a project manager. He's very passionate about time management. And he's made it a fine art coming up with these planners. He loves talking about it with his customers. So that's part of it. But it's also having the distance on that passion to say, how do I make this a profitable business? And how do I do it in a way that doesn't take up all my time every single day so that I can enjoy my family or enjoy my friends or whatever they like to do?
Did you find that they were all different ages, or was there kind of a commonality there? And how many of these were kind of like, this is their second or third venture versus this is the first time?
Well, those are good questions. They're all different ages. All different demographics. That's what I love about this whole trend is when you look at things like scalable startups, it's a very narrow demographic. And that's because of factors like access to capital and things which are changing a little bit, but they're really inching along. With this, some of them are crowdfunded and anybody can crowdfund. Women are actually more successful than men in crowdfunding statistically a little bit. Probably. So there's not really the same barriers that exist when you have networks of people that have always operated a certain way. Age-wise, I had at the same panel that Steve was on at the New York Public Library, the ocean audit owner, I had Sean Kelly, who's a 22-year-old who was selling rapper jerseys on the internet. He was at Rutgers University, and he was trying to get into the business school, but there was this math test he had to pass that he couldn't pass, so they wouldn't let him into the business school, and they said, you can go to the School of Arts and Sciences, and he's like, no, I think I'll just run my business instead.
I'll do it for real.
So he was like, you know, barely out of his parents' house.
Oh, wow.
And then I had Alyssa Shiro, who's a meeting planner, and she's sort of in between them in age, and she, you know, she's been doing it for a while, but she's not very super senior in her career. She's in mid-career. And I've seen that throughout. It really doesn't matter what age you are. It's optimizing who you are, what you bring to the table, you know, your resources. Some people, maybe if you're a little older, you would have more money to invest. Mm-hmm. But if you're
that's
younger,
not always a solution, is it?
You could stay up all night if you need to.
Yeah,
you know? And so it's figuring out how, you know, what, how do you make the most of who you are? It could be your personality. Some people are very good at sales and other people really don't like that kind of interaction. And they set everything up with a sales funnel online. And it's figuring out, you know, who you are, what you bring to the table, and how do you make the most of that in the time that you have. It's an exciting challenge if you really think about it.
It's really interesting because, I mean, obviously this is a space that, you know, I've written about trying to give people a model, right? Which is build, you know, your digital or other product, whatever that offering is, and then automate marketing, sales, and support. And I think that what you're validating is that there's people out there that have taken that same message and have built themselves a lifestyle business. And I think the trends are indicating that freelancers or independent businesses are going to, you know, exceed employees in the next 5 to 7 years, I think it is. So it's what one of the common things I'm curious about is, like, what did they indicate that they couldn't have done this in the past? Like, this is a new era because of technology, because of Amazon, because of some of these enablers. Like, what was there any commentary on that?
Well, it's definitely, like, that's just something that I've observed from interviewing so many, but I'm sure if you ask them, they would say that that's true. Yes, because when you think about it, like, I've been covering entrepreneurship for a long time, and I remember maybe 15 years ago, there were venture capitalists saying it was harder for them to find deals because startups didn't need a server anymore, right? They had cloud-based technology. When you think about the power of a mobile phone, we take it for granted,
right.
But there was a time when people operated without them. So in terms of a lifestyle business, right, if you want to leave the house, but you're going to miss phone calls from your clients, there are people of, you know, below a certain age who will never have that life experience of missing a phone call, right?
Right.
But you have laptops are so inexpensive. The internet is so inexpensive. It's so easy to network online. There are so many free resources on YouTube. If you want to learn anything, you could probably find a video on it on YouTube.
And I think the explosion of software as a service, like where you don't have to build a lot of stuff, you can just buy and customize, or, you know, there's something customized for your industry for it, solving a part of the problem. I mean, I think between just the last 10 years alone, the volume of whether it's marketing automation or sales automation or service, the tool set's incredible now compared to, say, 10 or 15 years ago, right?
Oh, absolutely. Plus, there are freelance platforms that didn't exist.
In
the old days, like if you were an editor, you would know freelancers, right? Or you worked at an ad agency or somewhere that usually uses. But now there's Upwork, there's People Per Hour, there's Freelancer. There are a lot of specialized industry-specific sites also. Like if you're looking for an engineer, there's also platforms to connect you to manufacturing resources and tools that you might need if you're a solopreneur. None of those existed before the internet. And I think every year they become easier to use, cheaper or free, even like free conference calls, like you and I
are talking
on Zoom, right? So if you're a business coach, it would have been really hard to coach somebody you never see across the world. Now it doesn't really matter. In fact, people probably prefer not having to get in their car and drive somewhere or get on a train to go meet you. They prefer to talk on the screen a lot of times. So that's incredibly valuable too. Video too is an incredible tool for people in terms of marketing. Like Alan,
content, right? Like YouTube and Facebook and creating the content like this, for example. Like this would have been a multi-million dollar endeavor to do a podcast or a
my goodness, yeah.
Show, right?
And and if it's good, that's the other thing is the gatekeepers are out of the way. When you think about it, like Instagram influencers, I found this really funny. I did a story about someone who does bikinis, a guy who makes bikinis, and he was at like $500,000 in revenue. And I said, how did you publicize it? He said, well, there's all these women who are bikini influencers, right? So you have to encourage them to wear the bikini and then post it on Instagram. And I thought, what a quirky career. But think about it. They would have been going through a modeling agency that was taking the profits. Now they control it themselves. And they can do it however they want. And they could do it from wherever, whatever beach they're on. They can be a bikini influencer, right? And there's so many influencers with food and nutrition, fitness.
Right.
You know, almost any kind of lifestyle thing. To me, that's incredible. You know,
I agree with you. I think it's an exciting time just because all these things have converged. And what the next 10 years are going to be is probably even more powerful. The level of technology and audience and just, you know, it's like you've just spent 10, 12 years proving that this works. And I think the next 10, 12 years are going to be, okay, well now how, you know, forget the one person, $1 million business. Like we're going to start seeing people blow through that probably.
Oh, there already are. They're the highest I heard of was from Richard Jalachandra, who was the chairman of ClickBank, that informational marketing. So he had heard of one that was at like 37 million, but they don't want to be public, a husband and wife couple. And there are definitely some I know of and have written about that are over 5 million. And the census tracks up to 5 million, but then they say they remove outliers, and the outliers include companies they think that might be misclassifying. So it is possible that there are some that have people that are contractors that really should be employees technically under the law. You know, I don't know who the companies are, but I have a feeling there are some that are not, but they just seem like outliers because we haven't seen it before. Yeah, it's going to be incredible what we see. And it's tremendously empowering to the average person, because when you look at how corporate life is, right, every survey you see, people just aren't happy in that world anymore. It's deteriorated.
Sure.
The pay is not as good as it used to be. Their salaries have flatlined. The benefits are not as good. They have no security. The company will discard them the moment there's a blip in the economy. So they know that.
Things alone are kind of rough, I think, for the type of person that would start these other businesses. And you're never doing exactly what you want. You're just a factor of what the big company wants.
It can have its purpose. I had a very good experience in corporate life. I really enjoyed my colleagues. I loved the work that I did. And sometimes you have the budget of a big company behind you. You can accomplish more. But I think the reality is almost everyone at some point will be in a position where they might need to start a business. So it's a great time, even if you do a side business, to do it. Sure. It's so much easier than it used to be. And you could do it for less than $100 in many cases.
It's crazy, right?
So there's no risk financially. The only issue is really mindset, I think, right? Because most of us, I have kids in school. I have 4 kids. And schools teach you you're going to have a job, right? So then when you get out in the world, if you don't do that and you want to start a business, people think you're kind of crazy, or they don't get it, or they think it's too risky. And so you don't have a lot of social support unless you happen to travel in circles where you're with a lot of entrepreneurs. But most people really aren't. I mean, I am.
This is a big issue for me.
Pardon me?
This is a big issue for me. And so I think you're hitting it on the head, which is like, we're sticking our kids into something that was really originally meant to make sure that everybody had an education, but it's never evolved beyond that. And there's a monopoly on education, not to belabor it, but there is a focus on labor, right? And being employed, as opposed to, like, you know, I think that we really need to, as parents, figure out how do we connect the real world. And what we're describing is only going to go faster and more available, and sending kids into that world of abundance with a scarcity mindset that, well, you can only do this little thing. You got to specialize, and more specialized, as opposed to you can create a lifestyle. And that's why when you write a book like this, I think it's very inspiring, first of all. So that's part of it, which is these alternative ways to educate people about the reality, right? Like, you've taken the cover off of a really powerful machine. Like, you've shown this is the proof that these are people are doing it with these tools.
Well, what I love is they're real. They're just everyday people. They're not people that were necessarily born into a lot of money.
Yeah.
They weren't the child of a famous entrepreneur. They, you know, they're just regular people that would be your neighbor wherever you live in America, and all walks of life, all economic groups. I've had people that don't have a college degree, people that have master's degrees. It doesn't matter in entrepreneurship. But to your point about education, one book that I found really interesting was The Underground History of American Education by John Gatto, G-A-T-T-O. He was an award-winning public school teacher in New York City. And the book is free online, but you could also order it on Amazon. And it talks about how the public schools were designed to turn us all into factory workers.
Right. And you can feel it. Like, you know, but, you know, there's a monopoly on this resource, which is schools in New York are getting 12 grand a year ahead. And the laws are such that you're steering 95 for 97% of kids into a system that has no connection to this faster economy and possibilities. So when we talk about mindset, it's like, we almost like, you know, do you isolate your kids' mindset over here while you're letting them do this, which makes no sense. It's like, couldn't we do much better things with their time? So that's part of the reason, I don't know if I mentioned to you that we started Founders Pack, which is, there's two parts to it, like connect founders with other founders. And I don't think you need as much money, to your point, as you used to. So what we want people to do is form their own pack. Right? So Founders Pack, form your own. And it's kind of modeled off the Japanese Keiretsu. And I think there's two parts to it. Young entrepreneur education, so that before they get to, you know, be a certain age, it's like, this is how you do a startup. and anybody can do, and here's the tools and possibilities, and then work with other founders, right? And then there's people that are founders or have ideas, and get them used to asking for what they need, which is not always money. So it can be technology, talent, relationships, and data.
Oh, so that's interesting. Yeah, and sometimes it's just community, like the community. People around you that get what you're doing.
That's the mindset part too, and the support, right, that you're talking about. So
absolutely. It's I think that's 90% of the battle, is realizing that it's something that you can do and it's acceptable, and that it's really, for some people, it's not that risky. When you think about it, if you look at a corporation, right, say you're a 45 or 50 year old man in tech, how many years ahead of you do you have in a corporate job, realistically, with the age?
Unless you're at a certain level, right? Because it doesn't make sense. Like,
yeah, it's just that, you know, certain industries, it's part of the business model to push people out who are experienced. Mm-hmm. But you doesn't mean you've lost your value, unless you think you have.
Well, and that goes back to your mindset, comment, and research. And I know we're probably tight on time, but you know, you pointed out that a lot of these people, and they involve themselves in masterminds and coaching. A lot of them are meditators. And then you also mentioned that they make an effort to connect with other entrepreneurs, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they are perpetual students. And I think that's really important, because there's no textbook. I mean, even though I've written this book, this is far from the definitive word on how to do this, because they're inventing it in real time. You know, right. But like, so much has changed just in the 2 years since I first wrote it. By the time it comes out, there will be new things that they're doing, new business models that are emerging, new, more efficient ways of doing things. And the only way you're going to find out about those is by talking to other people in whatever way you do it best. It could be on social media. It could be going to meetups. It could be just talking to the people that you meet at the gym when you're working. You know, you never know where you're going to meet other entrepreneurs, but it is about human connection. And I feel like with this size business, what's so nice is, it's not that they don't have any competitive spirit, but it's much more collaborative and cooperative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of nice when you come out of the corporate world and everything can be so ruthless. Even the startup world can be a little ruthless. But I think, you know, it depends on what type of startup. But I find a lot of these businesses are teaming up with each other.
Really,
and they have kind of friendly competitors, where when they're over capacity, and I do this myself, sometimes I can't take on a big project unless I bring in a friend. And they might be equally qualified to me. They do the same thing as me. But there's a trust there that we're not going to poach each other's main clients, right, and things like that. We'll help each other out so we can both go after the work. And I think that's something new and different. And I love seeing it, but I think it's essential for the one person business, right? You have to have those good relationships with people and help other people, and then you'll all grow.
I love what you're saying. It's definitely in line with my own purpose, and particularly the purpose around this new founderspack.io organization, where we're doing meetups, but then there's all these other pieces to address what you're talking about, which is really encouraging these founders and giving them a platform to say, how do I find allies and form alliances that help all of us improve? So that it's not just like, should I do this? It's like, no, this has got to be part of your formula. It's, you know, obviously you hit on the freelancers and the technology and focus and mindset, but then if there's this other way to create these formal alliances, it sounds like this is also a piece to the success of the people you've interviewed. So it's amazing. I love hearing that.
I think it is. They're so generous. I mean, one of the library events I did in New York City, three people flew themselves in at their own expense because the library didn't have a budget for travel. And I thought, I mean, how nice is that? Like 160 people in the audience, they flew there to share what they know with other people that want to start a business. And I thought, that's really unique. You know, it really, there was no speaking fee or anything. It was just to give back to the community. But I think they understand that we're all connected. And when you feel that way, it is what you talked about, a mindset of abundance. It brings a whole different spirit to your business than a feeling of scarcity. Like, oh, my speaking fee is normally $15,000 in the airline.
Yeah, I get it.
No, it's you know, which some people think that way, but I think it comes back to bite them, because they're thinking in too transactional a way. One other thing I did want to mention, which I thought was really interesting in updating the book, the $1 million one person business is a stage of business. Some people decide to stay there forever.
right?
Because they love it. I mentioned to you Matt Friel at Game Deal Daily. He sells classic video games. He's a gamer. He loves his business. And when we corresponded, he loves it so much. He doesn't want to go beyond one person and he wants to keep doing it. There were other people. Brooke Linen was a husband and wife team. When I first met them, they just raised $50 million in venture capital, right?
So,
so that's a startup, right?
That's incredible.
Yeah. And so what I think they have in common is when you master the business, when it's very small and you put systems in place, so it's very efficient and you build great networks of contractors, you have a lot of opportunity in front of you. And it's really up to you. Do you want a boutique business that gives you a great lifestyle? Maybe you do because you have young children or something like that, that where you really need a lot of margin around the business in terms of time. Or is it a good time in your life to become a startup? There's not really any right answer for people. It's really in your heart what you want out of your life. But it's different than running a marginal one-person business where you're struggling and you can't pay your bills and you're always in a mindset of scarcity because you really are living in scarcity. You are not making enough. You can't cover health insurance. That's a whole different world. And so The purpose of the book is to help people. You might be in that stage the first couple of years when you start a business. Yeah. Realistically, it's hard. But to get out of that quickly and then build a platform of strength and success and abundance where you're in a position to give to other people, and then you have unlimited opportunity ahead of you.
I love it. And I think that's what's so inspiring about this book. So I really personally even just thank you for writing it. It's amazing.
Well, thank you for all you're doing for the small business and entrepreneurship community. I think what you're doing sounds awesome.
Well, we want to help people make impactful ventures over the next 10 years, right? I think that's kind of what you're doing, and I think we're on the same mission there, so I'm excited. I realize we're probably tight on time based on your schedule, so, and actually even maybe mine, but so I'm going to wrap up with a few questions. First off is, how do people get in touch with you and how do they find the book?
Well, they can write to me on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook under my full name, which is in the show notes. I won't even spell it because it's too hard to write down quickly. And you can get the book on Amazon or your major bookstores, Barnes & Noble, anywhere online pretty much has it. And I do write back.
By the way, it's Elaine Pofeld, but the D, there's a D in there that's kind of
silent D.
We'll put it in the show notes. Okay, so Elaine, a couple quick things is, one, and I think I probably know the answer, but I'd like you to say it, which is, how are you, Elaine, changing the world?
Oh boy, that's it. I don't know. I'll leave that to the jury of public opinion. Hopefully with the book, I'm opening people's eyes to the fact that this is an option for everyone if they so choose to be an entrepreneur. It's not for everybody. Some people do their most creative work in a job. And I was one of those people for a long time, and then my life changed and now I'm pursuing this. But I hope I open that option for people who maybe didn't consider it and come to enjoy it.
That's amazing. And that's an important mission. I share that with you. And actually, I want to invite you before I wrap up with a final question. The plan is to do a Founders Pack event in New York, and that'll be a regular thing, but maybe you could be the first presenter at the first event.
I would love to do that. You just tell me when it is.
We'll figure that out. I'm thinking we're targeting June or July. We'll announce something, but we can coordinate. It would be amazing to have you be the opening featured speaker.
Oh, that would be awesome. So let's talk about it. I do have an event in New Jersey on June 27th, but other than that.
Yeah, we'll coordinate something. I don't have a date yet, but that I think as we're talking, I think that'd be an awesome win for everybody.
Cool.
Great. Okay. So the final thing is, when we have interesting people on the podcast, we'd like you to nominate another interesting person or people to be a future guest of the Automate and Grow podcast. We usually talk to experts and entrepreneurs. The theme is obviously on automation or growth or both. So who would you, Elaine, like to nominate as a future guest of Automate and Grow?
You know what would be fantastic is Ben Hoffman at City Hunt. He runs a scavenger hunt company. It's $1 million one-person business.
Oh, wow.
I'm helping him with a book that he's writing. He's a big automator.
Okay.
he's got, I have learned so much from him just about all the whacked out things he does with his QuickBooks and things like that. He makes it fun, you know, and he's built a very successful business that gives him a lot of time. He loves traveling. He's a big meditator, by the way.
Oh, okay.
He's always traveling to Costa Rica to do all these interesting things. So wow. I think he would really connect with your audience. So I would highly recommend him. And if you'd like to speak with him, I'd be happy to connect.
Yeah, we totally, number one, I accept that nomination and we will appreciate the introduction. And it's Ben, how do you say his last name?
Ben Hoffman, Hoffman. And the company is called City Hunt. He started it at NYU. It's a scavenger hunt company that serves companies like Goldman Sachs, a lot of the big nonprofits. But he's got sort of a tech component to the scavenger hunts. They're really fun. I went to one on the boardwalk in New Jersey last summer with my kids. And he does it differently than, it's not the normal team building at all. He was an actor. He's very imaginative. So I think you would have a lot to talk about with him.
That's great. I'm excited. Thank you, Elaine. I really appreciate your time today. And I look forward to talking to you some more.
Thank you, Michael. That was fun.
This has been another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. We will see you on the next episode of Automate and Grow.